I'm William Shutkin.
And I'm Andy Bush.
Welcome to the Sustainable City Show, a new podcast where we discuss bold ideas and innovations for green, equitable, and climate-friendly cities with the people making them happen. Toronto was the first North American city to pass a green roof law in 2009, requiring new buildings or additions that are greater than 21,000 square feet to cover between 20 and 60% of their buildings with vegetation. Meanwhile, the U.S. government's General Services Administration has over 80 buildings with green roofs, spanning approximately 2.2 million square feet, which is about 48 football fields of green roofs. This includes what is believed to be the second largest green roof in the world, the U.S. Coast Guard headquarters in Washington, D.C., about as large as 10 football fields. Today in the U.S., there is well more than 17.5 million square feet of planted roof surfaces, which is music to the ears of my guest, Alan Burchill. Alan launched his company Urban Strong in 2014 to promote rooftop development strategies that integrate nature back into cities. Based in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, Urban Strong provides finance, engineering, design, and construction services for green roofs and walls, and to date has installed hundreds of thousands of square feet of green roofs and walls throughout the Northeast on schools, offices, restaurants, apartment buildings, and brownstones. Today, Alan joins me to discuss the state of green roof installations in the U.S. and abroad, the challenges, as well as the most promising strategies to a greener rooftop future. Alan Burchill is an engineer by training, with an MBA and a master's in sustainability management from Columbia University. He previously worked for the wind energy company Siemens Gamesa and is co-founder of the New York Agriculture Collective. Welcome to the Sustainable City Show, Alan. It's great to have you here.
Hi, William. Thanks. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate it.
Of course. Good to see you again. And for our listeners, they can't see the video that I see with that jungle-like green wall behind you, which is inspiring and dappled with sunlight, and makes me feel like you're in the rainforest versus there in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. But maybe, Alan, you could tell our listeners a bit about your company, Urban Strong, and what motivated you to start the company after your prior work in renewable energy.
Sure thing. So it is a little funny that you opened commented about the living wall behind me here, because it definitely makes coming to the office a rather zen experience. And
nice.
Whether you realized it or not, those are grow lights. It's actually dark here out right now. Those are grow lights for the lights. And so we have very much recreated the natural environment that the plants need here in the office, despite it being a dark, almost winter New York evening.
Well, gosh, Alan, you know, I should tell you, it really does look like skylights, you know?
And, oh, that's great.
With that natural illumination versus the grow lights, but that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I'm not just, riffing slightly when I say that it creates a very zen environment. I mean, there's all kinds of white paper studies done around the biophilic effect and the mental and physiological benefits of incorporating vegetation and natural materials into all of the environments where we spend time, be it where we live, work, pray, study, heal, you name it. But we're getting off course already, which I think may happen once or twice more.
Well, Alan, hardly. I love that line of thought. You know, I often ask colleagues and my own students if they know the answer to this question: what percentage of the average lifespan or health span is spent indoors, inside the built environment? Do you know the answer to that question?
I'm going to guess upwards of 95%.
90%. Excellent, Alan.
90? Yeah.
90%.
I'm sad to be right about that answer. I really wish it was not that high. It's depressing. And you know, this kind of dovetails back into your original question there. I mean, part of why I launched Urban Strong and the sort of ethos behind it was that I love nature. I love being outside. My favorite week of the year is I go back home and get together with my high school buddies, and we go on like a 5, 6, 7 night backwoods camping trip with no cell service, into the backcountry, carrying our canoe on our heads through the woods, and you know, and fishing for what we eat, and it's wonderful. And one of the things I love the most is just getting away from the city and connecting with nature. And it's just a real shame that so many of us, particularly those of us who are city dwellers, which now makes up more than 50% of our global population, it's a shame that we feel that we have to do so much to get away from the city just to connect with nature. And as I mentioned earlier, there's lots of white paper studies that are done now that show, you know, just what negative effect the built environment can have on our mental and physiological health and the social fabric and you name it. And so, you know, as I left the wind industry and went back to grad school at the Earth Institute, like you mentioned, I was looking for a new industry to sink my teeth in, potentially start my own gig. And I thought I was going to have to choose between one of several interest areas. I was very concerned at the time about the global freshwater crisis. I was still very interested in renewable energies. I was, you know, always had a side or interest in architecture or interior design or plants. But, you know, to say that I was going to have a career in plants makes me sound like a florist. And that wasn't really what I thought my mechanical engineering degree would bring me towards. Uh-huh. And then during my time at the Earth Institute, I found the world of vegetated rooftops and started learning about all the multitude of ecological services that they passively and actively perform, and how they're a bit of a veritable Swiss Army knife, a multi-tool of benefits and tools for battling climate change or improving, you know, the operational efficiency of our buildings or our communities.
Can you give us a sort of 101 on what some of those ecological / public health benefits are of the sort of standard vegetated roof surface? What are those?
Sure. So there's a whole realm of them. They can crudely be divided into two buckets: private benefits, public benefits, or environmental and financial. So, for example, when you cover a rooftop with vegetation, the vegetation, for one thing, the leaves of the plant, which actually act like solar panels for the plant itself, they intercept the sun's photons and they use it for photosynthesis. But those sun's photons, if the plants weren't there, would have penetrated, would have struck down onto the roof membrane, your building's waterproofing coating, and over time turn it into Swiss cheese. And that's how you get leaks and cracks and whatnot. Not to mention, it heats up that upper level of the roof surface, and then that latent heat radiates down. And that's one of the reasons why the top couple floors of most buildings are so hot in the summertime. It's because they've got that oppressive solar gain coming down.
So it's not only the heat rising.
Exactly. Even the heat rising in the wintertime,
warm air
up
being
from
lighter.
All the lower floors.
Yeah.
But then also you have that solar gain. So they're in the middle of like a thermal gain sandwich, if you will. And that's why the air conditioning bills are so high, or they just keep the window open. But when you vegetate the top layer of the roof surface, you protect the roof membrane. It's a bit like putting a case on your smartphone. And you also thermally and acoustically insulate that top floor. Sometimes the top two floors. The other massive benefit from a city planning point of view is that all the layers of a green roof, you have like a protection fleece, a growing media, the plants themselves, but you have a drainage and retention layer, a root barrier layer. All these layers provide mechanical protection for the roof membrane, and if anyone was walking around up there. But most importantly, they sponge up rainwater. So all of the cities in North America that have generous green roof incentive programs, like Toronto that you mentioned, Chicago, DC, New York, Philly, Denver, San Fran, Seattle, they may list a bunch of reasons why they are all for green roofs, and those are all very true, but the driving reason is storm water management. So, for example, in a city like New York, all it takes is 1/20th. That's between 1 and 2 millimeters for my metric friends. That's 1/20th of an inch of rain, and the New York City sewer system is filled up. The wastewater treatment plant can only handle so many gallons per minute. So the excess backs up the queue, backs up the pipe, and rather than pushing it up through our basement toilets and flooding our streets, it's allowed to overflow through these combined sewer overflow points. There are 460 of these controlled overflow points lining the New York City Harbor. And the one pipe system that we have down there that combines our sewage and our wastewater and our rainwater, that mixes and you get raw untreated sewage pumping into our public waterways. And that's a pretty gross problem. And the EPA is aware of this. So there is there's a consent decree, and they're fining many cities around the US that are dirtying the water. So the vegetation, when it basically sponges up, a green roof acts like a sponge sitting up on top of your rooftop, sponges up the rainwater and time releases some of the water, kind of like the way water takes time to percolate through a coffee machine.
Yeah.
Water takes time to percolate through the layers of the green roof. In that time, the plants use up about 50% of the water from an average rainfall event, and then it just evapotranspires out into the atmosphere. But that last 50% that does trickle down takes time to get through the layers and then go down
not
the
overburdening
into the sewer. It's sort of like peak shaving, the worst effects of the load on the sewer.
Yeah.
Not to mention, I mean, going back as far as the benefits here, I mean, presuming that the building residents have access to the rooftop, which isn't always the case, mm-hmm. but it's still worth it nonetheless, it provides a beautiful amenity space and an opportunity for residents to access nature. I mean, imagine in a dense city, being able to bring a cup of tea from your own kitchen up to the rooftop, hang out on a chair, you know, around some greenery and decking, and just have a cup of tea and enjoy your rooftop garden oasis.
That zen-like benefit, that public health benefit, that biophilic benefit that you noted earlier, which of course, during and post-COVID, more and more of us came to appreciate, as well as appreciating the reality that we do spend, in fact, so much of our time indoors.
Oh, absolutely. We had lots of calls, people saying, hey, you pitched us a couple of years ago, this is during COVID. They said, you pitched us a couple of years ago on a rooftop park. We changed our mind. You know, we're in. Can you build one next week? You know.
Well, let's talk about that benefit and risk or challenge of green roofs. So you've done such a nice job explaining for the layperson, you know, what some of the benefits of a green roof are environmentally and in terms of public health, but cost. So we often hear, I hear this as a developer and have seen it in estimates and pro forma, just how expensive constructing green roofs can be, let alone the operation and maintenance. Especially in climates like Colorado, where I am, where it can be, you know, very cold in the winter and scorching hot in the summer, simply keeping the plants, the vegetation alive, whether on a wall or a roof, is its own, you know, real challenge. But tell us a bit about the finances, both what it takes, you know, on average in a city like New York or Philadelphia or Chicago or Toronto to actually construct a green roof on, say, your average multifamily building, and what kind of financial benefit accrues to the owner of said building in terms of increased property value, if indeed these are perceived in an emerging market as value add versus potentially a liability. You know, a new buyer comes to buy the building and sees this green roof and says, "What is this?" and what's it going to take to, you know, maintain it? And do I even want to bother?
Sure. So before we jump into specific numbers, it's important to understand that, you know, we obviously get this call a lot. And when someone says, green rooms, how much do those cost? It's a bit like if an alien landed, grabbed you and said, how much does a car cost here on Earth? You know, it's a bit like someone asking you, hey, how long is a piece of string? How big is a hole? You know, there's questions that need to come back because it
tell us about the variables, the factors that go into pricing and building.
Sure. So cost is what the other thing I'll set up for this is that cost is one thing and then value is another. And so the things that drive the cost would be the, you know, they're priced by economy of scale. And so the exact same technology, the same type of green roof, and I'll get into what that means in a moment, installed on a sprawling 10,000 square foot warehouse rooftop that's only a single story and we can climb up with a ladder and easily reverse blow up the the engineered media with a blower truck. That's very different than the exact same final look, but only on the 450 plantable square foot roof of a brownstone, where we have to carry the material up a hatch on our back to get up to the rooftop. And, you know, the economy of scale is blown very badly there with such a small area. So the relatively those things can stretch out. Now, as far as types of green roof, it very much depends on what someone wants, much in the same way that I can go on Craigslist and get a car for $400, or I can go to Italy and get one for $400,000. It really depends. So if, for example, somebody, and the spectrum that we label green roofs on is the very simple, cheap, shallow ones that are the low-hanging fruit of green roof. If you were mandated, as a lot of buildings are in New York, for example, to build a green roof, we get calls that are like, hey, Alan, you know, give me the bare minimum to get the city off my back. Like, what's it going to take? Just anything that checks the box of green roof. That's, you get these simple, shallow, extensive green roof systems.
And what is that typically? What kind of vegetation, what kind of plant material is sedums, involved in that?
Sedums. And so sedums are nice. I mean, they're cheap, they're hardy, but one of their biggest benefits is that they can grow in a very shallow engineered media depth. So they can grow, if we really had you, in like 1 3/4 or 2 inches of engineered media. And that's nice because that's very lightweight. And green roofs, a lot of the time, even if someone wants it, a lot of green roofs get shut down because the roof structure can't support the load of a green roof. And you have to think about, what is the green roof going to weigh when it's fully saturated? Just like when you water your plant at home, if you pick up a bone dry plant pot, it's lightweight. You pick it up when it's full, it's considerably heavier. And the same thing goes with a green roof. So if it's a 4-inch deep system and it's fully saturated with stormwater, we typically say the rule of thumb is green roofs weigh 6.5 pounds per inch of depth per square foot. And we always talk in per square feet. And so the civil engineer or the structural engineer on the project they'll give the building owner, the architect or the developer, listen, this is the max this roof can handle. And then we get into not only the type of green roof, but how it's actually being used. But to come all the way back for a second, so you were asking about the scale and what can drive the price. So the type of green roof. So if the most lightweight, simple, shallow green roof is called an extensive green roof. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have intensive green roofs. Think of them as being super intense and wow. And that's how you get the wild, overgrown English garden look. You can sometimes have trees. And that's in order to have that wide variety of plant species, you have a much deeper area of growing media, upwards of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 inches. And then you blow wide open the options for plant palette in terms of all of those plants that require deeper and deeper root ball systems. And then if you mix and match somewhere in the middle, which a lot of green roofs are, we'll put nice intensive plantings and green roofing around the amenity deck or where people can easily see it and where people are going to go. And then maybe around the back out of sight where aesthetics aren't as important, we'll shallow it up and put an extensive system. So overall, that system would be what we call a semi-intensive systems, a bit of both, you know, bit of the high end, bit of the low end. And so that definitely the type can impact it. And then now getting away from cost for a second, there's value because you have to look at the benefits, because the exact same green roof can bring very different benefits depending on the building type. Most driving one, and you hit it, was property value.
Alan, just before you get to value, and I appreciate that, because that is and should be part of the costing and consideration. But sure. Can we just quickly sort of model a cost structure for, say, what you described as a small brownstone rooftop? Maybe it's 400 square feet of usable, livable sure. space. And let's say it's the sort of the lower end, an extensive sedum system. What kind of cost per foot are we talking about?
Sure. In New York, I mean, if someone had a brownstone roof with about 300 to 400 square feet of plantable area, and they wanted a basic, simple, shallow green roof up there, all in, designed, supplied, and installed, you'd be looking at somewhere around anywhere from, you know, $35 to $50 per square foot for that brownstone. So, you know, somewhere between 14 to 20, 25,000, something like that.
Yeah.
And that's all in. Now, many factors can drive that, you know, pretty quickly. And very quickly, that number from 50 can climb up to like 65 as someone starts to want to add other bells and whistles. Totally.
How about the regulatory costs? In a city like New York, a municipality, a jurisdiction that actually has a green roof regulations that wants to incentivize them, Is it difficult, as it is in so many building projects in places like New York, to actually get the thing approved and get the project done? Or is that something that you don't have to worry about as much?
So the answer there is also depends. Here in New York, we're spoiled with two different green roof incentive programs. One of them, the Green Roof Property Tax Abatement Program, that's very straightforward. That's a simple application that's open to everybody. And everyone in the city is eligible to get back as a one-time abatement on your property taxes in the following year. You'll get back $5.23 per square foot. So if you had a medium-sized green roof that was costing around $25 a square foot, you're getting back 20% off that cost in the following year. Mm-hmm. In some areas, though, they identified priority zones. And these were areas where not only stormwater management was an issue, but the urban heat island effect, that like in certain areas, air temperatures in the summer were very high. Heat-related deaths were higher. Asthma rates were higher. And I mean, it's important to understand.
The Bronx. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they layered in a bunch of different factors, and then certain neighborhoods came out as prime candidates, urgently needing more vegetation on their walls, on their rooftops. And so those areas are eligible for an enhanced property tax abatement of $15 per square foot. So now if you're it's triple. Yeah, almost triple the amount. So if now if your green roof was $20 or $25 or $30 a square foot, you know, you're getting up to 50% of the cost back, which is can be pretty great.
Mm-hmm. Great. So let's talk values. So for taking on the cost, the project, you as a property owner are going to get what in return?
So again, the answer is it depends. I'd say the two things it depends on, the biggest driver definitely is, can you justify the green roof improving? Will a green roof improve property value? And the green roof improves property values in one of two ways. Can residents at the minimum see it? Like, is it a setback, for example? Is it over top of a parking garage that one whole face of the building looks down on? And you can imagine the improved you know, view in New York City, a view to a green roof counts as a view to a park. And we all know what a view to a park does for real estate and dense urban centers.
Totally.
Or can people access it? So if people can access it, then it becomes an amenity. The world's fanciest gym, if the door is locked 24/7 and no one can get in, it's not going to do anything for property values. If you have a rooftop garden oasis that for insurance or whatever reasons, or it could be weight load, you know, the moment you want to allow people up there as an amenity space in New York, you suddenly need 100 pounds per square foot structural support in key areas of the roof rather than just the weight of the green roof itself. And so some building owners, when they call us, say, absolutely, we want it as an accessible amenity area. And other condo and co-op boards or property managers will say, no way in hell are we letting anybody up on that roof. And I get it, right? Like, I get both sides of it.
Yeah.
But if you can access it, and then it becomes, I mean, you look at the real estate listings when a unit in a condo or a co-op goes up for sale, if they have a living garden wall in the lobby, or if they have a green roof, it's often one of the top three, if not the number one, the leading image to highlight that building. It's just still so incredibly unique. I mean, in New York City, less than 0.1% of building rooftops are developed in any way whatsoever. So if you actually have a rooftop garden, that just sets your property apart. If you can start and end every day, you know, leaving and returning home to your building, walking past a garden, indoor garden plant wall, like the one behind me here in your lobby, residents love it. They just say, it's just, you get that little dose of zen, that little shot, you know, on your way in and out of the building every day. And so that really does miracles for property values. Now, there are, again, there's paper, real estate market studies have been done that shows that an accessible green roof in a building will boost the property values anywhere from 2 to 5%. But what gets really interesting is when I'm pitching to a condo or co-op board, I usually go on Zillow in advance. I look up and I determine what the average unit value is in their building, multiply by the number of units in the building, and then take that number, which is often in the millions or tens of millions, and multiply that by the
most conservative 2%.
Yeah. And I even ask them in the meeting, I'm like, I show them a picture of a rooftop garden. I say, look, all of the things being equal, if one, and you were looking to rent or buy a new place and one of the buildings had this, how much extra would you pay? And people, I'm like, give me a percentage. And they start throwing out numbers and they're all higher than 2%. And I say, let's just do it most conservatively, 2%. And that number frequently comes out in the millions. And I'm like, well, good news. Your green roof only costs, X thousands of dollars.
And it's love that story.
But that still is tricky.
Yeah. And but you're able to put, real numbers based on market studies and comps. But equally interesting and exciting, I think, is the whole idea of, activating these voids known as rooftops. Part of what's made solar so exciting for urbanists is the idea that, we start to view urban rooftops as more than just a place, for an HVAC unit or worse, but rather it's where we can actually install PV and model green practices. But of course, PV in comparison, as you say, to the solar panels of a plant looks pretty sort of cumbersome and industrial versus, those wonderful roofscapes that we've now seen many of us with, various kinds of grasses and even tree species and ground cover. So the idea that we're sort of reclaiming roofs and in your case, walls as well, as active spaces, as beautiful spaces that also enhance the value of the building itself, of the property itself. That's a pretty compelling case.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I am constantly pushing the idea that I want to change the way that people philosophically view their rooftops. I want them to start viewing them as buckets instead of lids. With whether it's solar or green roofing or a rooftop farm or a rooftop amenity deck or hybrid versions of any of the above, it's never been easier to start turning rooftops from headaches and cost centers into sources of joy and revenue. Money is literally falling out of the sky. Solar panels catch that money and print money for you. And the thing, if I start to get pushback, because we sell both, we sell the consulting for, here's the best way, given your structure, your goals, your finances, local incentives available to you. And so we help them understand the development, but then we help them with the design and implementation of either solar or green roof. And without getting too kind of crude, I say, look, I don't care which one you develop it as, but I got to ask you, if you're giving any resistance to any of the above, what else are you going to do with that roof? Mm-hmm. You're doing nothing with it. You've done nothing with it for the last 40 years, and when I fly over New York City, I look down and again, less than 0.1% of rooftops are developed in any way. And it's like, I understand if you don't want to go up there, it's dusty, it's dirty, it's just mechanical equipment. So at the minimum, park a bunch of solar panels up there. Like our solar proposals now in New York City, thanks to the community solar model, they have payback periods of 24 months, and that's incredible. And again, like, okay, if I'm wrong, if you're wrong and you regret this, 2 years is paid back, like the risk is so low. But if I'm right, which plenty of hedge funds feel I am, and the rest of the solar world is, you should be developing your rooftop in some way, do something. Yeah. Otherwise, you're just letting the sun turn your rooftop into Swiss cheese. I believe that we have two core beliefs at Urban Strong, sort of moving back for a second. Number one, we believe in the power of plants, vegetation specifically, to improve our buildings, companies, and our communities. And then number two, we believe that in large sprawling cities like New York, rooftops are the front lines in our fight against climate change. And by transforming these otherwise, mostly unused roof spaces into green, spongy havens, energy hubs, sustainable farms, we can turn the tide in this pivotal battle and create resilient cities for the future. And oftentimes these two beliefs go together in hand in hand.
Yeah, that's a good business case for sure, Alan. Well, tell me a bit more about a couple of things. One, Urban Strong's own products. I remember when you and I first talked, you would just spend a couple hours in your little R&D, you know, your lab space there at the Navy Yard. I can't remember what it was exactly you were working on, but you're actually sort of experimenting and designing and developing your own rooftop technologies or products, right, for sale. In fact, that living wall I'm looking at behind you, isn't that something you actually sell kind of at a retail level?
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about those products and especially your walls. I'm interested in the sort of the vertical versus the horizontal installations. But
sure.
How much food production are you actually encouraging, consulting on food production as part of the vegetation of roof surfaces? And what kind of rooftop ag are you looking at?
Absolutely. I mean, my dream roof, if I had 5,000 square feet in New York City to play with, the majority of it is going to be vegetated. There will definitely be a rooftop amenity deck because, you know, with maybe a solar canopy over top shading part of it, the rest of it can be in the sun. But, you know, you do want some shade on a rooftop on a hot August day. And the rest of the vegetated area is going to have a solar integrated green roof in it. A lot of people think that they have to choose between rooftop solar or a green roof. And so while it's not our creation, we import a product from Germany, a solar integrated green roof racking system. I know your viewers can't see it, but we have a demo bay right there behind me. There's plenty of
it's a little agrivoltaic kind of
precisely
product.
Yeah, precisely. And so the idea, there's benefits there, but the idea is you can have your cake and eat it too in the exact same footprint, and the vegetation underneath the solar panel keeps the solar panel operating at a higher electricity production efficiency because it's kept cooler and doesn't overheat and lose efficiency. But also you just get all the benefits of both systems in one on the same footprint. But my ideal roof, sure, so it has amenity deck, solar integrated green roof everywhere, but I definitely want a corner of it set aside for a rooftop garden. Now, I have no illusions. I mean, no one will tell you that we'll ever be able to grow all of our food needs and meet all of our, you know, caloric needs up on a rooftop. But we can supplement it, and we can have contribute a certain amount to food security if they're commercially operable rooftop farms, and we can create jobs up there. We can be harvesting and donating to local farmers markets or other organizations. But you know, leafy greens, tomatoes, there's a lot of things that can be fairly easily grown. I encourage built multifamily buildings to say, hey, much in the same way that you may carve up the parking garage and assign plots, lots, spaces, you could carve up the garden area and have a little community garden up there. And so everyone gets one square yard on a sign-up basis and, you know, grow your own tomatoes. It's very zen. It's again, very healthy. There's been studies we've done. It's very healthy for us to get our hands in the dirt. Great teaching opportunity to show kids who live in the building where their food really comes from. It's not tomatoes aren't born plastic wrapped on the shelf at the grocery store.
No, it's a total win-win, Alan. I love the vision and the reality. A quick sub question, and I want to get to the walls, the vertical part. I mean, typically, and I've often heard about the risks in terms of weight-bearing buildings. And are most of our existing buildings capable of bearing at least some kind of lighter or extensive rooftop garden? How big of an issue or challenge is the problem of weight that you referenced earlier, you described earlier, and our typical buildings of, say, the last half century, many of which are no doubt workhorses, but some of which might well have some shoddy construction. I think of spec buildings, you know, from the 70s and 80s. Typically, how much of a concern, Alan, is that with your clients, your market?
Definitely. And let's also talk about leaks, because weight and leaks are the two concerns. Those are the two things that people kill green roofs in people's eyes. So first of all, regarding weight, I would say that first off, there's no risk in the sense that any city that's worth its weight or has any kind of respectable department of buildings is going to require extensive structural engineering studies to be done. I would want to make it clear to listeners that green roofs are highly, highly engineered systems. All of the products in the lasagna stack of the components of a green roof, each one has their own product data safety sheet. It's known precisely, for example, depending on what they call the ingredients and the composition of the engineered media, we know exactly how much a square yard of that cubic yard of that weighs when it's dry and when it's fully saturated. And of course, we take the fully saturated weight when calculating what kind of load is this green roof going to impart on the roof. So there's very precise stormwater calculations that are made. Green roofs are highly predictable, highly engineered systems. So we know what the worst case scenario is, and this is run, it has to be signed off by a professionally licensed structural engineer or architect, and they submit it to the Department of Buildings. The Department of Buildings then comes around afterwards and checks to make sure that what was designed was actually installed. So as long as we trust the science and the structural engineers, everything is fine in that regard. Most buildings can handle right away a lightweight, simple green roof. Where buildings I can't handle it is when people say, oh, and I want it to be accessible. We want it to be an amenity space. And to my point earlier about property values, I don't blame them, right? And there's a lot of people who say, well, hang on a second. If we don't have the structural capacity to be able to go up there and enjoy it, then we're not building it at all. So that happens a lot. But I would say that there are many ways that we can get creative and we can build these little mini structural bridges from column to parapet, like the edge of it. We can basically do a structural engineering survey, identify the point loads of where the retaining walls and where the heaviest moments of support are, and we can build platforms for the amenity deck. And when you really get into the nuances of the code, the entire roof doesn't need to be able to support a rave. You basically identify this is where people are going to hang out, and the pathway that goes from the rooftop door, the stairwell bulkhead to that pathway, that's what's looked at. But everywhere else, you don't need all that structural support.
So very customizable, very knowable.
Very predictable.
All subject to code and
yes.
Makes sense. And then the leak issue, as you say, I mean, that's also a potential.
The other thing, I just want to come back to the support for a second, is you would think that it was the newer buildings that are okay, but in many cities, including, New York City, for example.
The brownstones, the great old masonry buildings.
They updated the building code in 1968 because they realized that we had unnecessarily built unnecessarily strong rooftops prior to 1968. So they built these lighter, flimsy ones. And then they reversed all that, about 15 years ago. And so brand new buildings, everyone wants rooftop amenity spaces. But, that period between 1968 and, 2000-ish, those buildings are the concern. But pre-war buildings, you could land a fighter jet on those rooftops.
Yeah, I mean, Lewis Sullivan and H.H. Richardson and Cass Gilbert, Plus a lot of really nice brownstones in Brooklyn Heights, which are
as far as leaks. You brought that up earlier, and so an undeveloped rooftop where that membrane is just exposed to the elements, the sun is chewing it, turning it into Swiss cheese, and people walking around on it, rooftop mechanical equipment, maintenance engineers, people, they walk around little sticks or gravel or pieces of hardware like screws. If their boot accidentally grinds on one and makes a microscopic tear in that roof membrane, you have a leak. And the leak doesn't go straight down. It goes down, it goes across, and then it comes down. Very difficult to find. When you bury that roof membrane in all the various inches and layers of a green roof, again, it's like putting a case on your smartphone. So when people say, oh, I don't want to put a green roof on, I'm worried it's going to cause a leak, I say that's a bit like saying, I don't want to put a case on my smartphone, I'm worried it's going to scratch it. It's the opposite. It's the best way to mechanically protect your roof. And then from a cost point of view, any building owner, any long-term building owner, like schools, hospitals, co-op and condo boards, where they know they're going to be owning that building for decades, roof membranes are a consumable. They burn through those. And, it's $15 a square foot to replace it, more if you have to tear off two existing layers to put a new one down. So when you add a green roof onto your new membrane, it's, it's probably going to outlive most of the people on that board. There are original membranes underneath 60-year-old green roofs in Germany right now, where it's the original membrane. So think of all those decades, 60 years worth of leaks and cracks and repairs and membrane replacements, and all that material going to landfill. None of that happened.
Yeah, that's
so that's definitely something that we put into our model when we help people understand the 25-year cash flow cost benefit analysis of green roof versus solar versus a nitty deck.
Alan, I'm sold. I mean, can you come to Boulder tomorrow and price, give me an estimate? No, seriously, you make a really compelling case. And what I appreciate is your mechanical engineering training, plus your management training, plus your own sort of career path that got you to this, which is all, legit and impressive. We just got a couple minutes left. I'd love you to talk about the vertical. So, we often, talk about green roofs and vegetation on the rooftop, understandably, but of course there are other dimensions, other walls, other surface areas on a building, and those are the vertical ones. Now, I've seen many vertical projects. There was a project near me in San Francisco, circa 2014-15, on a local private school, a very nice, expensive, I believe it was a day school, maybe a secondary school, in the Laurel Heights neighborhood. They had a beautiful, maybe three-story vegetated wall. It's San Francisco, so it's the marine layer. It's a lot of fog and moisture and sunshine. Tell us about the vertical walls and what you do, what you sell, and their benefits.
So the vertical garden walls have similar benefit sets to green roofs when they're installed on the exterior. They're sequestering carbon, they're thermally insulating the building, acoustically insulating the building. They do manage some storm water. They're providing habitat for birds, bees, bats, butterflies, other migratory species, and reducing our footprint, urban sprawl's footprint on the local ecology, and sequestering carbon, if I didn't already say that. They're also cleaning and cooling the air, so combating urban heat island and cleaning the dust particulates and other volatile compounds out of the air. And they're just beautiful to look at. There's been plenty of white paper studies that have proven that sight lines to nature reduce our blood pressure, reduce our heart rate, reduce cortisol in the brain, which otherwise left to build up is what creates stress in the mind. There have been studies shown that sight lines to nature, tree canopies on streets, vertical living garden walls, accessible green roofs, or even green roofs that you can see in areas, in certain areas, will reduce crime rates. I mean, imagine that. This sounds like, these plants sound like a magical ancient mystical tool from a sci-fi movie, but you really do perform all those benefits. And then on the interior, I mean, you get many of the same benefits, but the focus there is on mental health and especially productivity and creativity, especially in, this post-COVID world where companies are trying to tempt back the work from home crowd. I like to joke, I like to make the serious comment, I suppose, that living walls are becoming the new air hockey table for the tech companies, to tempt their workers back.
That's true. It's true.
Look behind me. Like, wouldn't you said at the top of this call how much you enjoyed it? People, all other things being equal, people want to be around this. And so we have a variety of living wall technologies behind that. When you park the plants and look in behind, there's different technologies available on the market. We have also DIY'd and engineered our own solution for living walls that are below 100 square feet. And so we will consult with building owners and help them understand their benefits and price points and options for different technologies. And then while we definitely prefer a living wall system, I mean, they do have the requirements for lighting, plumbing, ongoing maintenance. And for some people, that's not interesting, or maybe they're renting and they know that they're going to be gone in a couple of years and they don't want to make this investment in the plumbing and the irrigation. And while we do retrofit plenty of spaces, it's still, there is an added cost there. And so there is a whole other product line that we have that still taps into that biophilic benefit, and it's basically the taxidermy of plants. And so this is preserved ferns and mosses And I mean, again, your viewers at home can't really see it here, but that wall there is made up of different dripping ferns and mosses. And so it's a way that you can basically coat an entire wall in real natural greenery. Now it's been preserved with a food safe glycerin, so it's not going to lose its color or its texture. It literally requires zero maintenance. We have people promise they're just literally never going to touch it. Just like
what's the typical shelf life of an installation like that? It depends.
And so we've scoured the planet looking for the best sources, and we know enough to know that there's good moss out there and bad moss, and we've got a great moss dealer. And we know that we'll warranty ours for upwards of 8 to 10 years, whereas I know that there's a lot of other lower cost moss in the market which will start to fade or turn a little crispy or crunchy, or just basically you don't want it, you know, 2 to 3 years down the road. So it is really important that you work with a reputable firm who's done their best. And we also go a little bit further up the value chain, and we've looked into the total sustainable footprint, and we know where ours is harvested from, and they're engaging in, you know, sustainable harvesting practices in a way that the moss isn't, you know, totally stripped from an area, but only selectively harvested so that by the next growing season, it's already grown over.
Good. So you're thinking about that supply chain,
green
roof, green wall supply chain, which is impressive life cycle thinking. Hey, Alan, we've got a split. You know, in your honor, I pulled up my Bosco Verticale virtual backdrop from Milano, which I, of course, love. And
it's beautiful.
Is proof positive of everything you're trying to do in this country. If only we could be as forward thinking as the Italians. But I just love what you're doing, Alan. I applaud your entrepreneurship, your vision of a greener city, the fact that you're doing it in New York and in the Navy Yard is impressive enough. And I wish you great success in growing the business. Your success will be, I think, a good indicator of how the field grows, greening cities, integrating nature back into cities. I had the pleasure of doing a similar conversation with Eric Sanderson. Have you met Eric?
I don't believe I have.
From the Bronx Zoo. He's a senior staffer at the Wildlife Conservation Society, but he wrote the wonderful coffee table book, I don't do it justice by describing it that way, called Manahatta.
Oh, right, sure, yeah.
And then the book Terra Nova, among other books. And he's recently become a real expert in urban climate resilience, looking at ecosystems over time, over, you know, millennia, and mapping them to discover, say, you know, where there used to be ponds and wetlands that have long since been paved over or covered over, which is why, you know, out of nowhere during heavy rain events, folks are suddenly flooded, even though they, you know, they don't see a body of water within a mile. Yeah. So anyway, at some point, I'd love to introduce you to Eric, who's just upriver from you. But great luck with your work, Alan. Thanks for spending an hour or so with us today talking about your work. And let's stay in touch, okay?
Thank you. If I could leave your listeners with one parting thought, and you kind of touched on it there, bringing up Manhattan. I would really like to come back to this idea of the power of plants. And I would like people to understand that nature is this incredibly powerful source of design inspiration for companies, city planners, and architects. And I would really want all of them to start looking increasingly to rely on plants and nature for many important decisions. I mean, nature is effectively a gigantic R&D lab that's been testing and iterating for 3.8 billion years, and it's completely free to access this if you know where to ask. And in many cases, like right here in cities, I mean, think about the tremendous effort that's spent beating back nature. And really, I mean, nature wants to be our unpaid intern and solve so many problems at once. We just have to, you know, let it in and manage it in a controlled way. And I mean, a vegetated rooftop, as I told you, or a vegetated wall surface just simultaneously solves so many problems. And if engineered and designed right, doesn't really take that much from us in order to present back a very attractive return on investment. And we'd be happy to help anyone listening, if they have any questions or want to discuss any potential projects with us to help justify it.
That's so well said, Alan. It really is. Plus a good plug for Urban Strong. Well, I see you as standing on the shoulders of Janine Benyus and Bill McDonough and even my late friend Steve Kellner, who was really the first to write about biophilia as a serious matter of environmental policy research and design and planning. I know increasingly my students are interested in biomimicry, biophilia as an approach to the built environment. And what we need are more projects and products of the sort that you're developing to make the case.
Need more podcasts like this. All the info and all the education and the technologies out there, we just need it disseminated in a way that incredible podcasts like yours do, William. So I thank you for having me on here and giving me the platform to sort of disseminate some of this information and help get the word out. Thank you very much for having me.
Of course, Alan. Next time I'm in Brooklyn, I'd love to stop by.
Please do. Yeah.
So great to have you.
Thank you, William.
See you soon.
Take care.